It's a delight to be here today. Thank you for welcoming me to your pulpit. I like to tell people before I preach that I often write and therefore preach into the beat or spoken word tradition, depending on your age. And so there may be periods where I'm speaking what feels like too fast. Just let the words roll over you. You'll get the words you need. The rest of them can just wash away. It's okay. There are no borders at sea, none that are visible, anyway. 2 weeks ago, at this time, I was just getting off a ship. We had been at sea on a cruise for a week, stopping in sun-drenched Caribbean ports along the way. Sea days, ones with no ports, were punctuated only by meals while endless cobalt waters rolled by the windows. Other days we docked ostensibly to go exploring in our four port cities. By some magic and a load of privilege, we didn't have to go through immigration or customs when we landed. That part was great. But the price of that was landing in this artificial, encapsulated world, a little village in each port constructed specifically for people on cruises. This was new to me. I'd never been on a cruise before. My partner and I started calling it the trap. Filled to the brim with tourist paraphernalia and services, these artificial spaces were a man-made entryway to the countries we were visiting. They were sort of an airlock. Having lived on the other side of that equation in an unprotected tourism port in Maine, I can see the benefit in shielding each from the other. Tourists get a buffer, so do the residents. On the other hand, the ways in which cruise ships exploit local communities could fill volumes. Insiders working with outsiders who can paint clay, making sure some people never get access. It's the bread and butter of mass tourism. It's also the bread and butter of modern society. Simply put, economic and social inequity is how we live the way we live. And for those of us in UUism, especially for those of us who have been in it a while, this is or should be a major problem. We believe in equity. We believe in justice. We believe in compassion. We believe in welcome. And we do believe in borders and boundaries, but not based on heritage or financial or traditional social rank. We draw the lines in other places. What are your ethics, your morals, your integrity? Do you take action for what you believe in? If, like some of the people who have recently lost jobs over public racism, you do something that affects your social rank, so be it. It's okay for your behavior to affect your social stand. But how much money you have shouldn't affect it. The color of your skin shouldn't affect it. Your faith by itself, what you believe in your head, should not affect it. I deeply hope that your actions based on your faith do affect it, and strongly. That's how it should be. So on Friday, my Twitter feed had yet another angry white woman, this time in L.A., telling yet another immigrant that she didn't belong. Fortunately, a bystander named Maria started videotaping, telling this woman in no uncertain terms that her behavior was unacceptable. Compassion is important, politeness is useful, but it can become an easy road to making excuses, enabling, and failing as allies to ourselves and to others. Sometimes, it is a mercy to call someone's failures into the spotlight to offer them an upgrade in the choices they're making, or to eliminate the problems instead of hiding them away. And sometimes, it's a social responsibility. Holding a boundary is not always bad. Maria was holding a boundary of community and social standards. But it's not always good. The angry white woman thought she was holding a boundary, too, of national identity and borders. Sometimes, rules of belonging are toxic. And sometimes, telling people what it takes to belong is the thing that moves them to be who they want to be. If you believe yourself to be liberal, committed, transformed, act that way repeatedly and people might believe you. Support people acting that way. And they might join you. When you act, your actions ripple out. You are moving the borders. You bring your people with you. You become a leader. And you get to pick where you're leading. In Africa, Nestled into the embrace of Morocco's northern border, there are two Spanish cities called Ceuta and Melilla. What this means is that there's a tiny little piece of Europe on the African continent. I didn't know this until last year. Every year, thousands of Africans travel to Morocco to try their luck crossing the border there. If a person manages to touch EU soil, they are entitled to EU civil rights protections. As long as they remain on the Moroccan side, they are not. And both governments, both Spain and Morocco, spend a lot of resources holding that border. Now, there's a certain colonialist logic to the laws and structures defending the border from the Spanish side. It's not right, but you can understand how they got there. But what if the government of Morocco? Why would they spend thousands of dollars and vast other military resources to keep people in? Why would they care? Well, because as long as they do, Morocco has leverage with the EU. If the EU doesn't favor Morocco, the border magically becomes more porous. Oops. Spain and the EU are effectively paying Morocco to do their dirty work. It's inhumane to refuse these people admission to the EU. They trek thousands of miles to get there. They risk their lives to try to cross the border because the refugee process doesn't work properly for them. Strangely enough, white refugees seem to get applications approved much more easily. But fear is a powerful motivator. The EU is afraid of these folks, and they shun them as a way of addressing their fear. That's not so effective. In episode 221 of her podcast, Sex Gets Real, Dawn Sarah interviews queer trans attorney Andy Eisenson. They discuss the role of fear in the justice system and what happens when we stop using exclusion and infliction of pain as ways to try to feel safe. Right now, we mostly exclude people and inflict pain on them in order to make ourselves feel safe. Our justice system uses those structures almost exclusively. And it's not really working. If we manage to deconstruct those structures of retributive justice, which we have been taught from infancy, we are then free to imagine other structures. Structures where we can feel safe without inflicting additional harm. What if we could imagine structures of world governance that allow us to feel safe without inflicting harm on others? What kinds of border policies would that require? What kinds of national governance would that require? And when would it be important to prevent people from crossing borders? What are we saving? What are we sustaining? And why? If we are to live lives of integrity and compassion, we must find the places where protection of communities intersects with nurturing the world's wholeness. This is no easy task. The generations of brutality inflicted on the original peoples of this and other continents make clear the need for protection from the other in some cases. How can that horror ever be made right? How can anyone imagine risking it again? If every colonial descendant and settler were removed from this soil, I imagine the original peoples of this land would have to think very hard about letting anyone back in. And yet, here we are. In this emotionally and ethically fraught entanglement with so many of us uninvited and living embedded in systems the foundations of which horrify us. Revolting though the origins are, we have no other place to go. This isn't anything you don't know. More complicated is the fact that through enslavement and rape and intermarriage, there are no clear lines anymore. Many of us are from the mixed result of generations of colonialism more truly than we are from any one part of it or any other place or people. And any of us that are descended from so-called legal immigrants, like I am, have ancestors who were permitted to come here by people who had no standing to give that permission. We've never truly been cleared for entry. So now what? In my fantasy world, we decide as a nation to cede a controlling portion of our government to the Indian nations. We say that for the next 50 or 100 years, the presidency and 51% of both houses of Congress are to be Native people. Unfortunately, I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen. So what's the next most ethical thing? I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't involve barring the doors and building a border wall. I believe that the resources of this continent would be protected from destruction and shared. There are people whose homelands are literally drowning or vanishing or destroyed because of the excesses of this and other westernized countries. Do we not owe those people a home and a livelihood at the very minimum? With all of this soil and water and air, how can we not share with those people in need? If there is any right living left here for descendants of colonialism, it cannot be found in chasing away the people of the earth from Eden. Thank you. When I was a kid at the UU Church in Stamford, Connecticut, there were two pieces of theology embedded in our building. It was a big old stone Universalist church from the heyday of Universalist churches, right on what had originally been one of the town greens. And of course, Kitty Corner from the Congregationalist Church. There were two pieces of theology there. One was the pulpit, which was a simple dark wooden pulpit with a bas-relief chalice and God is love embossed on it. The other was a gray felt banner that had hung over the stairway that led to the basement of the main church building, which was kind of dank, but that's where the youth group met, of course. And it had a chalice and a poem by Edwin Markham. They drew a circle that shut me out, heretic rebel, a thing to flout, but love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle and shut them in. On the surface, that seems like pretty good inclusive practice. But it always rubbed me the wrong way. Who are we to force someone to stay? There are times when it's okay to let someone go. Leading the circle is important. Having the boundary is important. Knowing when you're in and when you're out is important. If someone doesn't have the freedom to go, then staying is imprisonment. And just because being inside the circle looks good to people inside the circle, that doesn't necessarily mean it's good for everyone or even good at all. I don't want to be white. I'm glad I'm not. I have no longing for that. I never have. I don't want to be straight. I'm glad I'm not. I have no longing for that. I never have. I don't want to be Christian. I'm glad I'm not. I have no longing for that either, although I will admit that for a while I wished I could have a theology with a relationship to the holy that took less than 15 minutes to explain. I was raised to you, these are the consequences. I enjoy being this person with these experiences and beliefs and identities. I think they make me a better human. I think they make me a good person. I'm proud of who I am, and after 43 years, I've even figured out how to like who I am. And in our world, that is a radical act to like yourself, to take care of yourself, even to survive if you are at all outside the mainstream. Audre Lorde alluded to this when she said, "Those of us who stand outside the circle of this society's definition of acceptable women, those of us who have been forged in the crucibles of difference, those of us who are poor, who are lesbians, who are black, who are older, know that survival is not an academic skill. It is learning how to take our differences and make them strengths. For the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us to temporarily beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change. And this fact is only threatening to those women who still define the master's house as their only source of support." Later, in another piece, she wrote, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare." This quote is often taken out of context, misused to imply that self-care is radical for everyone. That's not what Lorde was saying. What she was saying, in the context of her own liver cancer diagnosis and her own impending death, is that it's a radical act for a black lesbian to take care of herself, because survival is not something the rest of society wants for black lesbians. Thriving is not what dominant culture wants for black people, for women, or for queer folks of any stripe. So to be black, a woman, and a lesbian is to be thrice rejected. There are three circles shutting her out of the things that everyone needs: success, succor, and survival itself. And she's saying she's not having it. She will make her own survival insofar as she can and her own succor, and that is her act of radical resistance. She has descendants. Nia Wilson was killed on the MacArthur BART platform 2 weeks ago. We don't know why, but based on eyewitness reports and the account of the person who called 911 to have the murderer arrested, it appears that he was a white man targeting young black women. The 911 caller, another young black woman, literally made her own survival as he appeared to threaten her and other passengers on her train car. She should not have had to do that. But she did. And she did. And we can be grateful. Black women have been saving themselves and everyone else in this country for a long damn time. Too long. And who lets that happen? Who lets it be necessary? Who makes it be necessary? Who does that? Who decides that young black women deserve to die for existing? Who decides that refugee parents deserve to lose their children? Who decides that people in ICE detention are not entitled to legal representation or humane treatment? Americans do that, apparently. Americans driven by fear and unchecked by decency. Fear and anger and resentment and entitlement, and now we have a system that increasingly looks like white supremacist fascism. And that system is willing to kill to keep the boundaries from being breached. When we bond with a person or group, we get a stronger sense of who belongs and who doesn't. The more important the group is to us, the more important the boundary becomes. And eventually, the insiders become family. Oxytocin is the love hormone that helps this happen. It helps gestational parents bond with their babies. It helps romantic partners bond with each other. It also makes people more antagonistic to outsiders. It sharpens the sense of boundaries. Who is in and who is out. Sometimes that's great. Identity development in minority groups has to go through that stage. Sometimes it's terrible. Sometimes it leads us to cruelty or immorality or callousness. It's up to us to decide how far to take it and where to draw the line. And sometimes family is more than we should be. Sometimes it's okay for the borders to be porous. Sometimes that's how we save people. Sometimes that's how light gets in. Sometimes, like when our congregations don't want to grow or when our covenant groups or chalice circles don't want to grow, or when we struggle with new language or pronouns or music, we are a living microcosm of the larger zeitgeist. Fear is trying to draw our boundaries, and we cannot succumb to it. There are good reasons to have boundaries, but let them be about ethics and values and growing wisdom. Let them be about healthy and transformative communication. Let them be about learning and growth, and let them be guided first and foremost by deep discernment and self-knowledge and love, holy love, sustaining love, the God which is love, that love. Carelessness is not a luxury we have. This has always been a war of belonging. Let survival of the most marginalized be our radical act. Let the war